Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction, again, to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Well, things are heating up, and we're going to start off this. We'll start off this MP3, and I'll talk about the news and see if there's anything new in the news. We have the head of Dubai. Dubai's police chief plans to seek the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the head of Israeli spy agency over the killing of a Hamas leader in the Emirate. Al Jazeera television reported. They pulled off this big hit, but they left a trail, or someone left a trail. And you got all the little Jew rabbits all excited wanting to join the Mossad because it looks impressive. And they're tracing it. They're tracing it back. And it's been a big event. The interesting thing about it is that now, you know, you have the Arab world, which is the House of Saud, the Sunni. They're basically, you know, the Bushes are out there talking to them. You remember the Bush had old... The head of the House of Saud at his ranch in Texas, and they're in big with Anglosphere, and they're allowed to do whatever they want within reason. They got to sell us their oil, and then they got to take their petrodollars, and they got to invest those back in U.S. bonds, that type of thing. And that is where you get the term petrodollar. And so they're allowed to do whatever they want as long as it's part of the game plan. In reality, I've said this before, that they're indirectly in cahoots with Israel. There's a lot of conflict there, and there is a potential for a lot of conflict because they don't exactly have the same worldview, but they both have the same masters. And that's the problem with it. But it looks like that relationship has had a big wedge drive between it. A big wedge driven between it, because what you have in the Middle East is you have the Shia Crescent forming from Iran through Iraq, through Syria, into Lebanon and Hezbollah. And what has happened is you now got a big gauntlet thrown down between the Arab world and the Sunni world and Israel at a time when you wouldn't really want that division, in my opinion. It is very stupid if they did it. If someone set them up to take the blame for this, to drive a wedge in between them and the Arab world, that's interesting, because if Iran goes at it with Israel and the United States, the Arabs might not see it the way they would have last week or a couple weeks ago. This is a huge public hit where they killed a guy. It took them a while to figure it out because I guess they injected him with something, some kind of a muscle relaxant. And that's been the big story. Strat4 wrote its usual piece, you know, using intelligence from the hit. And it's become quite famous, but they tracked them, and they had a lot of fake passports. They will never find them, but they found the fake passports, and obviously it's a connection to Israel on some level, or so we are led to believe. But it's pretty interesting. And of course, you have the Haaretz editorial. Israel must defuse escalating tensions along northern borders. More of that stuff. It's got huge tensions in the. An Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights in exchange for the appropriate security arrangements and normalization with Syria would create a new reality in the Middle East. Good luck on that. Gaza rockets can now hit Tel Aviv. There's another report about Gaza rockets and different types of rockets in Gaza. According to James Defense Weekly, Syria has decided to provide the Iranian-backed Hezbollah movement in Lebanon some 250 of its 800 M600 surface-to-surface missiles. The M600 is a clone of Iran's Fatah 110 missile, which has a range of 160 miles, carries a 225-pound warhead, and unlike most of the short and medium-range missiles carried currently arrayed against Israel, has an inertial guidance system. This would give Hezbollah new precision capabilities. There's all kinds of interesting stuff going on over there. And the whole truth, I don't know. The direction goes toward war. Let's see here. Nicolas Sarkozy angers allies with proposed warship sales to Russia. Yeah, Russia wants to buy some type of helicopter carriers, some specialized plane that France makes, and France could use the money, and they cost about $400 million each, so they're buying a few of them. And this got Sarkozy in trouble. You know, whores are easily bought, that type of thing. Thinking about the unthinkable, a U.S.-Iranian deal. And this is George Friedman from Stratfor. Diplomacy versus the military option. Well, good luck. Good luck on that. Because any type of deal, what they're saying basically is that you've got Russia and China who agree to sanctions, and Russia agrees to harsh sanctions sometime in the future. And Russia could cut off their gas supplies, but Russia hasn't done it, and Russia won't do it. And so you have to find another way. They're talking about redefining the Iranian problem, and that's fine. But it's not fine for the neocons. And the neocons are now, of course, barking around Obama like they were barking around George Bush. And the neocons probably right now own Obama. I've heard George Soros compare him to Roosevelt, which is interesting. You know, Roosevelt was very unpopular, and then, of course, he went and defeated the Nazis and all that type of stuff. It's interesting for George Soros to make that comparison. But when it comes to Iran, you know, this is something I'm going to get into when the conspiracy rabbits. There, I was asked a direct question about 9/11. I'm going to go into that, but I'm going to point out something, and we'll come back into, and I'll talk about Iran, because 9/11 or the attack against the Twin Towers took us into Afghanistan, and of course they used that to take us into Iraq, didn't they? But when you destabilized Iraq, Iraq was the only thing keeping the Shia crescent from forming. You actually formed a Shia crescent, and that the Shia are not aligned with any of the traditional groups in Anglosphere. They're not aligned with Westminster. They're not aligned with Israel. They're not selling their oil. You don't have a bunch of, you know, you own Saudi sheiks, but you don't own Ahmadinejad. You don't own that. So taking out Saddam Hussein created a huge problem. Created a huge vacuum. And that vacuum has been filled by the Shia. So it's kind of interesting. They're in a classic pincer move. They went in somewhere and they got very afraid and did a knee-jerk reaction. And I'm going to come back to this point in a bit here. Because these conspiracy rabbits keep asking me questions, and so I'll answer them in the way I see things. And keeping it simple. It is said that Ahmadinejad is crazy. It is also said that Mao and Stalin were crazy. In both cases, with much justification, Ahmadinejad has said many strange things and issued numerous threats. But when Roosevelt ignored what Stalin and Nixon ignored what Mao said, they each discovered that Stalin and Mao's action were far more rational and predictable than the rhetoric. Similar, what the Iranians say and what they do are quite different. That's from Stratford. They're all talking about this potential redefining the problem. Well, let's see what the other side is saying. This is Zero Hedge. This is a financial news site, and they're quoting, War Council convened in Damascus past Friday, and this was March 1st, this was published, past Friday to prepare for Israeli strike. Iran president expects war between spring and summer. Well, that would be my next timetable. I said that last fall, well, it would probably be the next spring. And if it doesn't happen next spring, it'll happen next winter. I was asked if I think it could be 2012 or something. Well, sure, it could be. But generally, if there's not going to be a war, you're going to see de-escalation first, and you're going to see some type of deal. I just don't see that. I see escalation. And it's such escalation that the average person should be able to see it now. But anything's possible. But that would be my next time frame. So let's read what Zero Hedge is reporting. More from the National. Let's see. They're talking about the price of crude and what the price of crude may do. You know, it may go to $110 a barrel if they attack and stuff like that. And they're talking about this meeting between Iran president and Syria, Damascus, Syria. The timing of the meeting and the way it was undertaken and the ensuing press conference that was held at its conclusion all point to strategic coalition being reinforced. This is the Shia Crescent, of course. That's me interjecting. This is the build-up of a new front that will spearhead the confrontation with the U.S.-Israeli alliance and whichever Arab countries they may expressly or implicitly be affiliated with. Indeed, we are being exposed to a new discourse here, an unprecedented sense of self-confidence and unheard-of preparedness for retaliation. What is more troubling for the U.S. is that any potential effort to rekindle relationship with Iran is now dead and buried, as the new axis seems to involve exclusively Syria. For its part, the Syrian leadership appears to have made up its mind to close off the U.S. administration's trite and cheap flirtation with Damascus and opted for bolstering its tactical partnership with Tehran. Surely this is now just another white swan in a sea of black, which has now been duly factored in to various asset prices and whatnot. It's a very interesting article. And what they were talking about the meeting was, quote, with, I guess, interesting. It was between Syrian President Assad, Ahmadinejad, and Hezbollah chief Nasrallah to devise counterattack plans and assign tasks in the event of an Israeli offensive on one or all parties, wrote Atwan, editor-in-chief of the pan-Arab newspaper Al-Quds, Al-Arabi. Very interesting article. And they don't look too afraid. No, they look... They sound like they're very well prepared for this, almost too well prepared. And they're talking about what the price of crude will be. It'll probably go down at first or something crazy like that. Who knows? In this type of event, because things become unquantifiable, right? But I thought that was an interesting article. And then you got the dove in the cabinet, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And I'm not good with these Polish names, but he was Obama's foreign policy advisor that they shoved out of the way. And there was his letter to the editor in the Washington Post said, well, Rich and Cohen got wrong about my Iran views. And he goes on to basically to say that they should not attack them and that they're trying to yell anti-Semitism and everything else at him. You know, he didn't want Israel using United States airspace in Iraq to attack Iran because all hell would break loose. That's basically his point. His point is valid. And what he's doing is defending himself. You know, an Iranian bomb would be a disaster, but an attack on Iran would also be a disaster. The challenge for the United States is to avoid another war that would not only further isolate America and the world to the benefit of all its ill-wishers. The challenge is also to isolate Iran, make it pay a price for its intransigence, and assure Iran's neighbors that the U.S. nuclear deterrence is credibly available for their protection. The problem is the neocons are having none of it. They want war. They want war, war, war. The Brzezinskis are very, very, you know, he's always plotting and scheming four and five moves ahead, and he's very diplomatic and much more dangerous, actually. The neocons are crazy. They'll get a lot of people killed, but they're nuts. And having these war councils convened in Damascus, of course, you know, they want to go at it with them. And they can't handle someone talking to them like Ahmadinejad does. They just can't have that. They have to fight. They have to fight to the death. It is their nature. And we will soon see this thing go, I'm guessing. Like I said, I was asked if it could be long. Sure, I mean, you're only, where are you at? 2012 is what, a year and a half away? You're already in March of 2010. So, you know, December 31st, 2011 is not that far away, but it'll happen probably before that. And this time frame between spring and summer is what I've been told. A lot of other people are whispering that. Doesn't mean it'll happen. I watch trends. I don't know anything that precise, or I'd give it to you, you know. April 15th at 9 o'clock, Eastern Standard, the world will start. I don't know. I'm guessing it has already started. It has already started on some level. But parties have been prepared for this very long, long time. And I will come back and talk about this, the problems created by taking down Iran, and why they were so stupid to do that after the Twin Towers came down. I'll talk about this again. And let's go on to something more entertaining. Police, this is Reuters now, police nab porn hacker behind Moscow traffic mayhem. Russian police said on Tuesday they had arrested a prankster who hacked into a computer system to show pornographic movie on a giant advertising screen, causing havoc on a busy Moscow thoroughfare. A two-minute clip displayed on a video screen above the main road south of the Kremlin caused midnight traffic jams and a frenzy of excitement across the Russian blogosphere. Police said the hacker gained control of the screen by breaking into an online company server in the volatile southern region of Chechnya, as he didn't think the police would go looking for him there. The hacker is a highly educated, temporary unemployed, and extremely advanced internet user. I'd say so. The scandalous film was talk of the town. The 40-year-old man said he wanted to give people a laugh. The popular daily newspaper reported, Russia 24 television said an elderly motorist suffered a heart attack at the wheel after seeing the scenes. So this is a hacker in Moscow, using a server in Chechnya, to hack into, to a very, it's not an easy hack job because he's out of work. You see, the problem with white rabbits is they become unpredictable. Now, when I first saw this, when someone first sent me this, and they sent me the brief headline, I said, oh, no, you know, someone put up 1488 in downtown Moscow. You know, he basically took control of the big Sony, like the big Sony TV in Times Square. He basically took control of it. I thought that was funny. But, of course, it was porn. But, you know, you start getting these hackers out of work, and look out. You know, some programmer out of work. Look out. That's what we've been talking about. There is literally one of these somewhere in the West or somewhere in the white countries every single day. That's a huge public event. Now, what would Russia do? They'd probably hire him. You know, this, if you can break into that, it's not easy. It's not easy to start breaking into computers like that. You've got to be somewhat, you've got to want to do it, and you've got to be somewhat talented. They probably hired him. And we'll go on right now, and I'll go into the conspiracy rabbits. And I'll answer the questions they're asking me. There's some breaking news that I was just alerted to, that the I'll read the Jerusalem Post version because it's an interesting one. It's the jpost.com. West drafts weaken Iran sanctions. This is just out. Russia, China oppose full banking embargo. Russia also opposes weapons embargo. Interesting. Western countries under pressure from Russia and China draft a blueprint for a fourth round of sanctions against Iran, which would tighten the ban on trade between Western banks and the Central Bank of Iran. That's CBI. Israeli radio reported overnight Friday. Diplomats at the United Nations were quoted as saying that the United States, Britain, France, and Germany accepted Russia's proposal that the West only ban trading with newly established Iranian banks and not increase existing trade limitations with the Central Bank of Iran. China holds a position similar to Russia's. The new UN draft for sanctions against Iran would put the Islamic Republic in a blacklist of countries obligating all member states to avoid trade with the country, but does allow smaller entities like the U.S. or entire bloc of European Union member countries to implement their own sanctions. Russia proposed that the oversight on trade with Iran be made according to a similar model as the current global trade with North Korea. Additionally, Russia opposes a full weapons embargo against Iran. A Moscow official was quoted by Israeli radio as saying the deal to supply Iran with the S-300 anti-missile defense system would go ahead. During a recent visit by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the country, Moscow promised not to implement a deal to sell the system after Netanyahu convinced the Russians that such a move would destabilize the regions. Now, let me interject here. What's happened is, this is fascinating stuff. is, you know, they went to Moscow and they said, don't sell them the S-300. And supposedly, according to Israelis, the Russians said they wouldn't, supposedly. And this, now I'll continue. This is where it gets interesting. The S-300 is considered the best system of its kind today and can engage multiple targets at once. Israel views Iranian deployment of the system as a serious obstacle to any potential aerial attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Although the arms deal was signed several years ago, it is yet to be implemented. However, a prominent Israeli-Iran expert, Dr. Ronan Bergman, has assessed that Iran has already been supplied with the system and has deployed it. Remember I told you, they said they had the system via parts, or they got the blueprints and put it together, or they bought it in a roundabout way. The U.S., France, and Germany would have the U.N. Security Council discussing the new drafts in the coming weeks. And then it goes on to talk about Hillary Clinton, with of course, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, getting involved. More. Iran is already under three rounds of U.N. sanctions. You know, this is the fourth round of double-top secret probation. So what we have here is the Israeli people being told by the Russians that they didn't sell them, that they're not going to sell them the S-300. Now the Russians are saying they are going to sell them the S-300s. What on earth is going on there? It's kind of odd. Or maybe they've already sold it to them and they're just going to lower the boom on them. The Russians don't care what anyone thinks right now. Let me read you another direct quote that came out in the Wall Street Journal. This is an opinion piece, an expert's long view on the Capital Journal section. An expert's long view. They quote Brzezinski. And Brzezinski was originally the Taliban was foreign policy advisor, and he is not a neocon. He's the other side of the equation that does not want war in any way, shape, manner, form, because war is the death of a lot of things. And I will quote directly. Thus, it's important to craft sanctions in a way, this is direct quotes, that doesn't stimulate more anti-Westernism or a fusion of Islamic extremism and nationalism. He'd keep talking to Iran too. Most major issues internationally that have been resolved by negotiation have involved negotiations over a long period of time. And he would avoid at all costs a military strike at Iran's nuclear facilities. Iran, he said, would make no distinction between an Israeli or an American strike. The Iranians would strike at us in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the Strait of Hormuz. If energy prices then soar, we will suffer. The Chinese will suffer. The Russians will be the beneficiaries. The Europeans will have to go to the Russians for energy. In effect, he argues, America more than Iran would be isolated. He is right. And Russia is playing everyone for a flute. The Russian-German-Italian axis is all go. That's what he's not saying. What he's not saying is that They're out of moves, and they got to do something, and they got to do something drastic, or at least certain parties feel that way. Mr. Brzezinski is much, much smarter than most of the other characters there, with the exception of, like, the George Soros, which wrote the book American Supremacism and didn't want to go to war. In the next MP3, you're going to be getting, this is number 33, number 34, which is going to be out a lot quicker. Maybe a couple days after this, maybe within a day. I'm going to go in to a serious event. I've been asked by the conspiracy rabbits to, the white rabbit conspiracy guys, the guys and gals that are listening to this, to go into a few events, my take on a few events. So I'm going to talk about one, the one that started the ball rolling, the one that brought everything out in the open where everyone could watch them panic. If you knew what you were looking at, I'm going to go into some of this stuff. Now, moving right along, there's obviously been a couple national disasters. There's been a huge earthquake in Haiti. There's been another huge earthquake in Chile or Argentina? Somewhere in South America. I can't even remember. I'm not even up to date on these earthquakes. But what I will look out for, because there's probably going to be more of them, you know, when it rains, it pours, is the earthquake in Haiti itself did not kill that many people. The latest earthquake in South America did not kill many people. And they're talking about building codes and everything else. That's part of it. Where natural disasters kill populations in Haiti is when something like that happens and they cannot really come back and take care of themselves. That's when disaster happens. Right now, the disaster is ensuing in Haiti. The real deaths occur afterwards, you know, a month afterwards or 2 months afterwards. Now, we're down there helping, but you can't help out that much. You can't help out that many people. In South America, again, you deal with the same thing. Once they start starving, once something happens like that and they can't adjust, you end up in a very challenging position. It's kind of like the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Once that happens, you go into survival of the fittest, and the rabbit that's most fit to survive in a disaster is the rabbit that survived more disasters, and that's white rabbits. Yeah, we've survived more disasters than anything on this planet, bar none. I'll say that no holds barred. We've survived more than anything in the solar system, bar none, period. We're the disaster survivors. But that's where the metal's going to meet the where the metal's going to hit the road. If there is any type of big disasters that in, like, let's say California or something, like something outrageous like the conspiracy rabbits talk about, that California goes off in the sink, something that we can't adjust for, that's when America will have to back down and Europe will have to back down and buckle under and things like that. But where the disaster comes in is shortly afterwards. Because a lot of people are saying, well, earthquakes didn't kill that many people. Well, the challenge comes in afterwards. The challenge comes in getting things back together and the type of advanced planning that needs. Because once a civilization is there and the group like the Haitians can't maintain it or can't keep it up, once it gets leveled, it's done forever unless someone comes in and rebuilds it, and America is too spread out. But these disasters, I haven't went into this, but I'll give you a taste of this. These type of phenomenons, whether it be earthquakes or strange events, large, colossal events, are happening all over our solar system. It's not just on Earth. It's all over the solar system. I was asked about what my take on this, but I haven't really informed my listeners. But I will give you one example of a quote from NASA Administrator Bolden, B-O-L-D-E-N. And he's talking, this is in July 2009. I don't know how many of you saw the Hubble image of the asteroid that impacted the planet Jupiter. This was, of course, in July 2009 and left a big black spot. And the spot represents several Earths in diameter. That got everyone's attention all the way up to President Obama. Emphasis, and they add emphasis to President Obama. So I think that's an interesting quote. There are stuff like this happening all over this solar system. It's time for change, as the man said. Change is going to happen. There's massive changes coming on all over the solar system, and I've talked about this as we come into what you can call third light into 2012. And we're interested in the clean break and making sure we have a home, obviously, but there's a lot going on out there that it's just impossible to keep up with it all. But there are huge changes. Huge changes going on all over the solar system. I've been emailed a question about the Russian professor that talked about America being split up, and they wanted me to comment on this. I think I've commented on this before, but I'll do so again, maybe from a different angle. And his name is Panarin, Professor Panarin. It's P-A-N-A-R-I-N. And if I didn't pronounce it correctly, I'm sorry. Doesn't say that America's collapse is a foregone conclusion. I'll just quote you directly as a quote that was sent to me. There's a 55-45% chance right now that disintegration will occur. He's talking within America, he says. But if it comes, it will be driven by three factors. Mass immigration, economic decline, and moral degradation will trigger a civil war next fall and the collapse of the dollar. Around the end of June 2010 or early July, he says, the U.S. will break up into six pieces. Well, we're approaching there quickly. He predicts that the economic, financial, and demographic trends will provoke a political and social crisis in the U.S. when the going gets tough. He says that wealthier states will withhold funds from the federal government and effectively secede from the union. Social unrest up to and including civil war will follow. The U.S. will then split along ethnic lines and foreign powers will move in. A Russian think tank put that out, and that was done, I believe, last year sometime. And many people laughed at his prediction. Well, he said a 55-45% chance. Under most normal conditions, most normal historical conditions, that would probably happen. We're not under most historical positions. Also, anytime you read something like this coming out by a Russian think tank, especially someone like this professor who's well known in the Kremlin, you need to ask a question. Why is this information being produced? Who benefits from this? Most likely there's more going on than meets the eyes, and they're provoking fear. Because the Russians could probably do that. The Russians and the Germans together could probably cause that to happen. So what they're doing last year, or whenever they put this out, is most likely provoking fear. Under normal historical circumstances, that is what would happen. And I'd be talking to you already from East Berlin, where I'd buy property pretty reasonable, and I'd relocate parts of my family, and I'd put all my money into definitely a local German bank, and half of it in Russian rubles. And I'd get ready to come back into America to help out family once it all comes down, and to probably buy some beachfront real estate, because America's already balkanized, and it would be, well, the Africans would probably be genocided. Maybe even the Hispanics too, because of the type of weapons you have. It would be a mess. Why don't I think that scenario is happening? Well, you're in a totally different type of calendar. You're not in normal events. There's a lot of negotiating going on. And when something like this comes out of Russia, they may be sending signals. Most likely were. Not only from them, but from Germany as well. German soft power. Germans are great actors. They have some great actors in office there. And they're sending smoke signals, telling people what's going to happen if they don't do something, maybe. But under normal circumstances, that would be an obvious play. I don't think you're in normal circumstances for one particular reason. We got to remember that that if you thought something like this was going to happen for sure, fiat, the Italians, of course, I've talked about a Russian-German-Italian axis as a go. It's a done deal. The Italians would not be allowing fiat to come in here and buy Chrysler. They'd wait until it goes pennies on the dollar. Germany would not be calling in Hillary Clinton to work out a deal for General Motors, worrying about those General Motors patent. Germany's, Chevy's, Chevy, if you have a Chevy car or truck and you look on your grill, you're going to see a cross. You know, it's a kind of a distortion of a Maltese cross, supposedly. Germany has always been involved with General Motors. So if they're coming in there and doing things like that, I might expect a reorganization. I've talked about this before. I wouldn't be surprised to see America collapse and be put into reorganization of some kind, or to see some pretty wild events put on the operating table so people could do some operating on America. It definitely needs that. So that wouldn't surprise me. But I don't expect anything long term, like something epic and earth ending, like you might see 100 years ago. If this were to happen 100 years ago, you very well could see the place split up like that. But anything I expect to see would be short term only, simply because of the amount of deals going on behind the scenes between Germany, Russia, and Italian companies. You know, you got to follow the money and certain elements within Anglosphere, especially America. You wouldn't expect to see deals like that if this is what they were really expecting. But you got to always ask, why is this information being produced? Who benefits from this? And it is most likely a ploy from the Russians on behalf of the Germans to get something. Something along those lines. Could they cause that to happen? Sure. Sure. You know, you have a German air base. I believe it's in southern, it's not in southern United States. It's out west. I want to say it's in Texas. You have a German air base. Most people don't know that. The German Air Force is already out west. Most people don't know that. The Luftwaffe, or however it's pronounced, Luftwaffe. They are already out west. They come over here to train and everything else. So you have a lot of interesting things going on across the board. But I keep your eyes open. But in my opinion, I don't believe it's gonna happen like that. It may be put in the operating table, and it may come sooner. It is gonna come sooner rather than later. In other words, they go to war, the place collapses, gets put in the operating table, is pretty hairy for a couple weeks or something like that. But they got big things planned, and this is not just a normal turn of the wheel of history, so to speak. We've had some interesting developments just recently in regarding royalty. I've told you about the European houses, and one side marks Sumer to ancient India into Germany, and another side gets a little complicated in ancient Egypt. But there's been some movement of late at the top, with the Queen of England declaring that that William will succeed the throne, will basically get the throne prior to 2012. Well, that's pretty interesting. William, I've been asked about royalty because obviously if you listen to this, there's some elements in Anglosphere and Western civilization that I don't like. at the top at least. It has nothing to do with people. It has nothing to do with white rabbits. This is pink rabbits and pink rabbit banksters and elitesters. And I can safely say there are elements in the media all over Finland, all over the Ukraine, all over countries that I don't mention that I'm sure we all dislike. Especially in the media. But it was at one time newspapers and TV. Now newspapers are bankrupt, which is wonderful. And so it's mostly just the major media in these countries. Even in Iceland, I'm sure there'll be pink rabbits in the media causing problems. But we've had an event that really went underneath the rug about Prince William, that is the royalty of the United Kingdom, getting the throne prior to 2012. What's significant would be, I was asked about this because I never mentioned them specifically. What is significant is they come from a different maternal line. Diana is a directly different maternal line. Radically different, most likely, in origins. Legitimate white rabbit or something along those lines. And, of course, you got Prince Harry, who is dang near normal when it comes to shooting off his mouth and acting, you know, considering they're very rich. I guess they're pretty much normal compared to some of the others. There's also another interesting coincidence, which is kind of right in front of our faces, is neither one of them date within the traditional European royal set. They all date normal Aryan girl rabbits. Normal rabbits, nothing spectacular about them other than they're good-looking girls, which is interesting in itself. So we have a different maternal line coming to the throne of England prior to 2012, and neither one of them marry into any of these interconnecting European lines, or at least are not dating in those lines. I think that's interesting. There's also some interesting news that has come out. So when it comes down to these two young princes, especially Prince Harry, I don't know anything bad about them. They're pretty much normal when it comes to European royalty, or probably way better than normal. And I'm sure Harry would be barking to say something if he ever got a chance. I was asked if I thought that most Americans really don't think of royalty too much, but they should, because those people have a lot more power than you think. The Queen has a lot more power than you think. Yeah, a lot of people answer to her that you don't know about. But, that is a significant event. And now I see Prince William and Harry is nowhere near what their ancestors on their father's side, were to us, which is interesting. But, fascinating stuff. But when it comes to Prince Harry, I was asked if I thought that was his legitimate father. I have no idea. I guess the big conspiracy around Europe is that Prince Harry has a different father. And, you know, his mother's Diana, but he has a different father. I would have no idea. I would have no idea. And they would never bring that out public at all. But he acts normal. He acts pretty much normal. You know, the one significant event in his life is when the kid puts on he didn't put on a uniform. He put on the uniform. The most recognized uniform in the history of the world. He wore a swastika. And now you got me thinking, you never know about old Harry. Hail Harry. That's funny stuff. But the ideal that a prince like him, one of the most visible people in the world, could put on that uniform without knowing he was putting on that uniform, or without thinking about it, on All Hallows Eve, walking out to a Halloween party, is pretty much impossible in my mind. I mean, that kid had to have known. Not only is he putting on a uniform, he's putting on a uniform at a very important evening. All Hallows Eve. It's basically Celtic New Year, that type of thing, or coming close to it. But it's very, very interesting stuff. You can only imagine, you know, if someone's driving this kid to a Halloween party, they're talking to him at a Halloween party. If Horace the Avenger, if I were to show up at your Halloween party wearing a Nazi uniform, people are going to notice it. On my way there, they're going to notice it, and I'm a nobody. If I get into a cab, the driver's going to notice it, and these kids don't move without people being around them. So what are the odds of him doing that and not knowing it, saying it was an accident? I think it's kind of funny, actually. Now, you got me thinking about Harry. Hail Harry. But they seem a lot more normal than the usual. I don't know a whole lot about them, other than they seem more kind of, you know, besides the fact they have tons of money. They seem very normal in spite of the fact they have tons of money. And we'll have to see. They do that some of the typical royal stuff, but Harry can shoot off his mouth. I can see Harry giving them a big, in your opinion, I'm a racist. You're just saying it because I'm white. Anti-racism is a code word for anti-white. And the fact that he put on that uniform, I was asked to comment about this stuff. The more I think about it, the more I realize how impossible it would be for him to do that by accident. You know, you got to have some nuts to do that. You got to have some balls to put on that uniform. Anyone, the average Joe, put on that uniform to go to Halloween party. You'd have to have some balls. But for someone in that visible position to put it on and then to say he didn't know what he was doing, you've got to have balls. Yeah, balls to do it, because you're going to obviously take a lot of abuse afterwards. And he did. It was kind of funny, but he's been accused of racism and everything else. But the interesting, but they are a different maternal line. They're a radical different deal, in my opinion. And I'm going to, you know, but there are elements in Anglosphere that are A-OK. There always has been. There's elements in Europe that are A-OK all over the place. But we got an infestation of pink rabbits, and the red hippo, you know, we give them the big three words. You got to go. And that's all of them. They got to go. Because they're trying to create a blended humanity in only white rabbit holes. Only white rabbits are subject to this. But we've had some big news on royalty. Because Anglosphere, you know, they link everything into ancient Egypt. And that is the pink rabbit banksters and elitesters do as well. That type of thing. We have some big, big news. King Tut is the son of Akhenaten. Akhenaten, you remember I told you about the Hyksos. Akhenaten was thought to be the last king of the Hyksos. He was part Hyksos. And there is a ton of propaganda now coming out. King Tut was the actual son of Akhenaten with his sister. Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. And Tut's name was not Tutankhamun at first. It was Tutankhaten for the one god that Akhenaten worshipped. Akhenaten only worshipped one creator god, or so he made up. And this creator god was both male and female, and that type of thing. Very interesting stuff. And this comes out from Zahi Hawass, which is the famous Egyptian guy. Z-A-H-I-A-W-H-A-W-A-S-S. Like ass. Ha-ass is his last name. But King Tut, the son of Akhenaten. And I'm going to read you some of the press clippings, because the stuff going on is pretty fascinating. Why is this coming out now? So basically we have the maverick pharaoh, where the Hyksos basically topple Egypt. And then they went and lived in Jerusalem, basically. I wonder who they could be. And then they used an ancient story about a famous event, Moses and the 12 tribes of Israel. Most people assume that Moses existed with Ramses II, or one of the Ramses, but that's like someone arriving to this planet and assuming Moses existed at the American Revolution. You know, Ben Franklin uses the story of Moses. Moses leading the 12 tribes at the American Revolution and that type of thing, at the founding of America. They've used this type of terminology. A lot of people have. That doesn't mean that Moses was alive there. You know, Ben Franklin is not Moses. He's just using that story. But what no one ever stops to ask is who else has used these stories? Who else is fooling around? And I'm going to talk about some of this more. But this stuff is coming out that King Tut is the son of Akhenaten with Akhenaten's sister. So his mother is not Nefertiti. Interesting. Let's see. King Tut's DNA reveals a more manly pharaoh. Oh, yes. Of course, the human condition writes that. Interesting stuff. So-called, the feminist depictions, Akhenaten looks extremely weird. If you look up Akhenaten, he looks extremely weird. He's part Hyksos. He's mixed. And they called him the polluted one. He tried to take Egypt monotheistic, and they just destroyed all kinds of stuff. And he was backed by the Hyksos, and the Hyksos had powerful elements that made money trading slaves. That type of thing. And the Hyksos toppled Egypt. Look up Hyksos. Manetho, the actual Egyptian historian or writer or whatever, on the Hyksos. Manetho. I can't think of how that's spelled, but you can look them up. Stuff is coming out on these guys. The feminized depictions are therefore likely to be what researchers call a royally decreed style, most probably related to the religious reforms of Akhenaten. It is unlikely that either Tutankhamun or Akhenaten actually displayed a significant bizarre feminine physique. In other words, the faces and forms are familiar to museum goers, and amateur Egyptologists may be no more than artistic license. Maybe no more than artistic. In other words, they're trying to say Akhenaten didn't look like that. Maybe did, maybe didn't. not very flattering. The idea that he would make himself like that under artistic style, because he, Aten is both a male and a female, a creator god. You know, he's just one god, a creator god. Therefore, he's both male and female. And that's the story. That's an interesting story, isn't it? Is it true or are they lying? Let's see, National Geographic. King Tut, mystery solved. Boy was disabled, malarial, and inbred. Interesting stuff. King Tut's close-knit family. King Tut played by malaria. King Tut's father was not Egyptian Quasimodo. He was Akhenaten had a genetic disorder to cause him to develop feminine features seen in his statues, including wide hips, a pot-bellied female-like breasts associated with the condition gynecomastia. Now they're trying, this is National Geographic just recently, but now they're already trying to spin that. Interesting stuff. It's fascinating, because King Tut was laughed at by most of his contemporaries. Let's see here. Tracing King Tut's Family Tree in London by Nick Gilbert. And of course, they say now that genetics has unraveled the connections between the mummies, they're talking about Akhenaten and King Tut, the intertwining of these influential lives have been revealed. It is fascinating that after so many eras and generations, the mists of time are clearing. The 18th century dynasty, which stuttered after the death of the golden boy Tutankhamun, is now of more interest than ever before. The complete picture we have before us now would be superbly complemented by an in-depth exhibit to present these people through their monuments together as they were tied together to each other by blood, a great family remembered millennial after their deaths. So we have an 18th century dynasty, Akhenaten, a renegade pharaoh who was most likely killed by one of the Ramses or something along those lines, and Tutankhamun, who is thought to have died with a blow to the head or something along those lines, becoming even more controversial. Because remember, the reason Tutankhamun, King Tut, is famous because they found all his gold. They found all his gold buried mysteriously. Yeah, they found all this kid's gold. And that's why he's famous. There's nothing really special about him. He's only on the throne for 9 years. But now we know why he's special, don't we? Fascinating stuff. You got to read between the lines a little bit, but not really. It's pretty much right in your face. Now, this is the most interesting information. Now, this came out. This was December 22nd, 2009. This is fascinating stuff. Because Akhenaten apparently birthed King Tut with his sister. Germany refuses to return bust of Nefertiti. And this is one of them. There were several of these reports. This is Press TV. Germany refuses to return bust of Nefertiti. Germany has refused Egypt's request that it return the 3,300-year-old bust of Queen Nefertiti, with German officials saying it was acquired legally by the Prussian state nearly a century ago. However, Zahi Hawass, which is the Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities, rejects the German claim, saying the bust was smuggled out of Egypt by a German archaeologist in 1913. He said repeated requests by the Egyptian government since 1930 have been ignored by successive German governments. Hawass's archaeologist Ludwig Borchardt disguised its true value by covering it with clothing of clay. Queen Nefertiti, the wife of Pharaoh Akhenaten, was renowned as one of the ancient history's great beauties. In 1346 BC, Akhenaten started to openly worship Aten and began a religious revolution in which Nefertiti played a prominent role. The bust is the star of attraction of Egyptian quality at the New Museum in Berlin. I don't know how to spell it, N-E-U-E-S. Earlier this month, Hawass said he would drop a similar demand for a permanent return of Rosetta Stone if the British Museum agreed to loan it. The stone is a basalt slab dating back to 196 BC, which was the key to the modern deciphering of hieroglyphics. So now they're trying to cut deals over the bust of Nefertiti, and the Germans are not budging. Nefertiti was an Aryan queen. She's going to have a very fascinating background on where she came from. Fascinating stuff going on. And does it have anything to do with Western civilization or white rabbits right now? Well, sure, because we have someone at the top of Anglosphere and parts of Western civilization trying to create a blended humanity. A bunch of Akhenatens, right? Isn't that kind of obvious? A bunch of little King Tuts. And what is wild about King Tut is the foreign stories. The foreign stories that came out just today. This was Saturday, March 6th. in 2010. This is tomorrow in Korea. It's only March 5th when I'm doing this, but this is the Korean time. So this is middle of the night coming out. You know, it's already the next day in Korea. But I will read this to you. And this is very unflattering. The Korean Times opinion piece. Short, nasty life of King Tut. By Dale McFeeters. Scripps Howard News Service. King Tut was worshipped as a god. He had his own cult and prayed to him to cure ailments and bestow favors. Fat of a lot of good it did him. It couldn't cure his own ailments, and he had a lot of those. Tut, it is fair to say, is probably better known in our lifetime than he was in his. It's just kind of funny. He became pharaoh at age 9 and reigned for 10 years since the discovery of his tomb in 1922. Yeah, they just mysteriously walked in and found his tomb full of gold. It has been a mystery as to how and why he died so young. Now, after extensive DNA tests and CAT scans, or CT scans, the results of which were published this week in the Journal of American Medical Association, the mystery might properly be why he lived so long. The kid was one sick puppy, and even with the palaces, the servants, the slaves, the worshipping throngs, the fawning advisors, and a young wife, being Tut couldn't have been much fun. The correct name was Tutankhamun. So much of a mouthful that you wonder if his staff and subjects wouldn't just call him Tut behind his back. Growing up must have been an ordeal for the lad. His father, Akhenaten, was a religious zealot who labored mightily and ultimately unsuccessful to instill the concept of one god in the Egyptians. The Egyptians would not give up the original sun god and the original moon goddess. They wouldn't give up their pantheon for his new god. I think there's going to be more about that. In other words, he wanted them to worship the red hippo. The Egyptians and the priests had made pretty good living out of them, preferred to stick with the sun god and the sky goddess, the earth god and the water goddess, cats, crocodiles, ravens, so on and so forth. You can bet they snickered behind young Tut's back about his father's weird religious beliefs. It says something about Tut's upbringing that as soon as he became pharaoh, he let his people go back to their old ways. Yeah, he changed his name from Tutankhamun to Tutankhamun. Tut's heritage was an array of health problems. He had curvature of the spine, a club foot, slightly cleft palate, and a receding chin. He was nowhere near as handsome as his famous gold funeral mask. He also had a degenerative disease of the feet and legs, which must have made it difficult and painful to walk, perhaps why 150 canes and walking sticks were discovered in his grave. He was prone, as probably a lot of Egyptians were, to bouts of severe malaria, one which, in a combination with a broken leg, killed him, the scientists found. Oh yes, he was inbred. Thanks to modern science, one's private little secrets are no longer safe, even after 3,300 years. Tut's mother was his father's sister. That's a lot of baggage for a little guy to carry in the office of pharaoh. Tut's indignities did not cease with his painful and premature death when archaeologists discovered his tomb. They were more interested in his jewelry and gold accoutrements than him and cut off his legs, arms, and heads and sliced his torso in half to get at them. You remember all that gold they found with him. He has been put back together, sort of, and the corpse of a sickly teenager is now on display after being traveling exhibit back to his original tomb. But it goes to show you that being a living god and now a dead one is not always what it's cracked up to be. This is an interesting article, and these are big, big events that are all coming out at one time. Pretty interesting. But the Germans refused to give back Nefertiti. They knew something. Yeah, we found out about you people. Yeah, this is interesting stuff. Were they going to try to find King Tut, pass off King Tut and his lineage as legitimate and say he was related to Nefertiti, you know, the golden boy of Nefertiti and Akhenaten? Were they going to try to lie about that? Interesting. Very interesting. Thank goodness for modern DNA. Now they're saying Akhenaten didn't really look like that, that's an exaggeration of artistic style. Well, none of the other pharaohs looked that exaggerated. Now, some people say that he's an Aryan, that Akhenaten was Aryan. No, he was part Hyksos. He was mixed. He might have been part white rabbit. I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that King Tut wouldn't be part white rabbit or something. I don't know. They know his whole genetic profile, though. They know his race, every element of his race. They know who's related to him and all kinds of other stuff. So, you know, they should release it. I don't doubt that Nefertiti wasn't White Rabbit. But this is fascinating, fascinating stuff right in front of your face. And you don't get that anywhere else, but this has everything to do with today. Sure it does. On some level, it has to. Because we have a blended humanity and only white rabbit holes. You know, and we got this, you gotta worship the red hippo. But that is Akhenaten, and he would have been their rendition of Moses, just like in America, you know, the ancient story of Moses leading the 12 tribes of Israel is played by Benjamin Franklin. That's what they are doing. They are moving themselves into the picture, illegitimately. Doesn't necessarily change the Bible, but it does open things up for discussion on who these were at these so-called Hebrews and whatnot running around Egypt. If you talk to my expert on the subject, and I'm going to go more into your resident expert, he's not necessarily my resident expert, but someone you can talk to, you can actually read his books and write about this stuff, who is an authority on such subjects. He can teach them at a seminary level and has, I believe, taught at universities. But anyways, Joseph P. Farrell says that the Hebrews were originally a group reconciling Egyptian and Sumerian history. Who knows what they were a couple thousand years after that. It's like saying the Republican Party was a legitimate white rabbit party, and it still is. Who knows what it would be, you know, 1,000 years from now. But the Hebrews were a very interesting group, and what was Hebrew in 1800 BC might not have been Hebrew, considered Hebrew, you know, a couple thousand years prior, this caste of priests. It's like a shamanic tradition or whatever they inherited. But he is an expert, and I'm going to go into more of this, but that this is fascinating stuff. I believe it was one of Akhenaten's uncle was a famous Hyksos who supposedly married into the 12th tribe of Israel, but apparently they were all laughingstocks around Egypt. No one really took them too seriously. You know, this stuff that had been long gone, the tribes of Israel, which apparently was stories that are thousands and thousands of years, a lot older than we think. But all this stuff is now coming out. I'm not an expert on theology, but I know some people that are. But that's why I mentioned the Hyksos long ago. I expected more of this stuff to come out. And, you know, the whole truth behind it. And I'm sure some people probably threatened all kinds of interesting things. But, yeah, they were most likely trying to pass off King Tut, which would be a pretty interesting story as the golden boy, the new man born to Nefertiti and Akhenaten. Just like they're trying to pass off Akhenaten didn't have some weird looking. He wasn't some weird looking guy. Well, he pretty had a sick kid. I mean, there's a lot of inbreeding all over the world, believe it or not. But this kid Tut, the young Tut, had serious problems from the marriage of Akhenaten to his sister. So what's up with them? I don't know. But I just saw I give you some news that you've never had, that you're not getting anywhere else, or it actually has happened right in front of your face, but you're not necessarily paying attention to it because maybe you're too busy or maybe no one's talking to you about this. But these are big events, and the Queen handing over her throne to William before 2012, all very interesting. Very interesting. Keep your eyes wide open and peeled right here. I will be back, and what are we going to talk about next? We're going to talk about, so I got to answer some questions here, but I had to move that in. I had to move that in because that is fascinating stuff. One more thing to add on old King Tut is a topic of inbreeding. When you get into Ramses or Seti, those lines are inbred up the wazoo. And you would think that would really take a toll on them. But in reality, it depends on what you're inbreeding, I guess. The experts say when you inbreed a hybrid, you inbreed something mixed, like Akhenaten was, and his sister was, you end up with a lot more health effects. If you go to South Africa, you'll find that certain elements of the Zulu are extremely inbred. They're very inbred. But it depends on what you're inbreeding. If you compare them to the Cape Town colors who are mixed white and black, you're going to see the Zulus don't have anywhere near the health effects of the Cape Town colors. If you go to Iceland, you see the inbreeding among the Icelanders, where a handful of Vikings and like 11 Irish women show up and created the whole island of Iceland, the most inbred population in the world, so much so that genetics labs like DECODE, D-E-C-O-D-E, have set up shop there, a European genetics company, to do research on them. They are inbred, but it hasn't hurt them at all, like you think it would, but it depends on what you're inbreeding. You know, hybrids, you know, why is mixing so bad? Because when you mix something, you destroy its potency. In the first round, you get something like Obama, who seems pretty, you know, he can talk, he seems pretty bright. But you inbreed, you start inbreeding hybrids, and you end up in big trouble. You end up with a King Tut. So they're making it sound like he was problematic because he was inbred. But what they don't tell you is that Seti was more inbred than him, and Ramses would have been more inbred than any of them, probably. But it didn't seem to hurt them. But what you're dealing with is you're dealing with elements of the Habiru, the Hyksos, the Habiru, H-A-B-I-R-U. And they were a mixed nomadic group of wild animals that ran around the plains. And somehow one of them, or a handful of them, or an element within the group, and they were part European. There were some Europeans there. I'm guessing there was everything there. They were a mixed motley crew of nomads. And one element of the group that became like the big warlord or whatever, well, he ended up mixing it up with Egyptian royalty and eventually was lucky enough to marry into something. And that's where this stuff comes in, gets interesting. Their famous King Saladus, which it's fascinating stuff, but saying that King Tut was hurt because of inbreeding, well, they're not telling you the whole story. Saying that Akhenaten was presented that way, presented looking really weird. He looks weird, all these deformities, simply because his one god was a creator god that represented both male and female. So they made him look both masculine and female. Male, they made him look both masculine and feminine. Well, that's a bunch of nonsense too. Aten is just in my opinion, was a dark aspect of a creator god. It's just another variation of Set. He was a nut. He was a nut. And this one god they created was a nut too. And they're lying, basically, in my opinion. I'd like to see a legitimate reconstruction of Akhenaten from his DNA, and they can do that. But I don't doubt that he wasn't part European. You know, some say his maternal line. I don't know about all that. I don't trust any of it. Because when you start putting all this stuff together, you know, they find this young pharaoh with all his gold. And then he ends up being related to Akhenaten. And everything you see, period. Everything you see, King Tut, Akhenaten, Akhenaten. And, you know, like they're some big deal. They're not. They were into some dynasty that, end of some carpetbaggers that rolled into Egypt. They were the end lines of them. You know, they were the end game. And their biggest problem is they copied the Egyptians. I guess these, the elements of the Hyksos leaderships did pretty well copying the Egyptians. The problem is that they copied them with inbreeding. And that was their doom. Interesting stuff. But inbreeding in itself, they're not telling the whole story. And it's interesting as you read these pieces, as you see these pieces come out. Of course, you should ask who benefits from this. Why is this being produced? Well, you know, why are they producing this? What's the big deal with Akhenaten? He's a nut. What's the big deal with King Tut, other than you found his gold? There's all kinds of neat stuff in Egypt you want to talk about. All kinds of fascinating stuff. Why? Why is that being produced? And that's where it becomes fascinating. And now I want to move on to a question from a more conservative listener. What is he saying? He wishes he would have listened to old Bob. I guess old Bob attended one of those meetings where he gave up and gave a speech about being on a consistent message, because then he wouldn't have to hear me. Well, you know what? You're right. You wouldn't. Because if you would have been on a consistent message, I wouldn't, or at least enough of them would have been on a consistent message, because obviously it was getting out, just not out fast enough. Or not out fast enough for Bob's fancy. You wouldn't. I wouldn't have been asked to do it. Brian wouldn't have asked me, and I wouldn't have done it. So you're right. There's, you know, I didn't dream this up myself, but that's kind of funny. He doesn't like this. He doesn't like the, he listens to it and likes it, but he doesn't like it. He thinks I should do more planning. I'll tell you a story, because I got an email from an old colleague of mine. They're calling this Yankee porch talk. There was one time when I was young and I was just, I am formally educated, by the way. You wouldn't know that by listening to this, but I am. There was one time when I was young and educated, formally educated, and I was going for an interview. Someone was nice enough to get me an interview at a big city at a very fancy place, and this type of job where you're going to analyze the world for them and that type of thing. And the people that got me the interview thought I was pretty bright and had some, offered a very unique insight. And, they were impressed with my style of thinking or something like that. They just got me an interview, which was very nice of them. And, in this interview, you're supposed to go in and hand a resume, of course, and usually most interviews you answer questions and stuff like that about your resume and, you know, standard stuff. But they wanted to do some type of presentation. And everyone was doing presentations, so I did what anyone who was formally educated did. I did what they teach you in college. You know, you do a PowerPoint presentation on the particular subject matter they wanted to know about. You know, something fancy schmancy. Which I don't even know if it's fancy. It's standard type stuff. You know, do a presentation. So you're going to do a PowerPoint presentation. You're going to put something together, a report for them, so they can see your style of analysis on whatever particular subject matter they wanted. So I did exactly what would be common sense. I did that. And the old-timer, who was very educated, more educated than me at multiple different degrees, he asked me when my interview was, and I told him, and he asked me and then we were talking, and off the cuff he said, "You didn't do some PowerPoint presentation, go in there tomorrow and do that. You know, you're not going to go in there and do some big presentation, are you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, isn't that what you're supposed to do? I mean, that's what it, so it sounds like that's what they wanted." And he's like, "Oh, no." He's like, "Oh, hell no, you can't do that, Horace." He's like, "They'll never hire you." He's like, "The reason the position's open anyways is because all you young guys, anyone with half a brain does that. That's what they teach you fools to do at universities. You know, you don't want to do that." He's like, "You go in there and talk to them like you talk to us." He's like, "What'd you do, practice all your $5 words and have some big, let me see that laptop, boy." He took a laptop and he says, "The only thing you go in there with is a resume. Give me that. I'll give it back to you tomorrow." This is a true story. I didn't have a job at the time. And so they kept all my stuff and I walked in there with a resume. Sure enough, they ripped off the top of my resume, they threw it away, and they said, "Now sit down and tell us about yourself." And then they asked me to give my analysis for a particular scenario, and I gave it to them flaws and all. No $5 words, or if I did use a $5 word, I butchered it, because, you know, obviously a presentation you usually practice. And so I did that, and sure enough, guess who's the only person that got hired? Me. Yeah, what would I have done? You know, and afterwards they're like, "Yeah, we're sure glad you didn't do one of those fancy presentations like they teach you boys to do in universities these days, because we would have never hired your tail, yada, yada, yada." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm too smart to do that." Sometimes that's not what the job calls for. Sometimes you gotta just talk to them like normal human beings talk to people and not be so prepared. People can instantly recognize whether or not you believe what you're saying, whether or not you know what you're talking about. You don't have to have perfect language. You don't, and I use something called, you know, market speak. If you've been around, let's say you're around London and you're around London Stock Exchange, they have a unique lingo. And I have one of those lingos. You know, it's market speak happens in any business. Your particular business, I don't care if it's a local printing business, has a particular lingo. And I have a particular lingo. And that's what they liked or what they wanted. And by doing a formal presentation, it would have taken it out. And of course, it was funny as I would have never had the job had someone not told me that. It wasn't common sense, but I guess it is now. So that's kind of what I'm doing here. If you don't like it, there'd probably be something else better for you. But calling it Yankee Porch Talk, that's funny stuff. And you wouldn't be hearing it. Yeah, you wouldn't be hearing it if more people would have been on a consistent message when asked to do this. Yeah, no doubt about that. But that's funny stuff. And I will be back with you on 34. 34 will be question and answers continued, but a little more detail, and there won't be any news to speak of. It'll be detailed. We're going to go off some deep end areas with these conspiracy, white rabbit conspiracy theorists. And I'll be back with you on 34. Thanks for listening.
This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.